Hi, everyone. I'm Aaron, and I'm going to be talking with you today about hyperbolic caching. So modern web applications today, they're everywhere. Users feel that they're important, and they're highly diverse, as you can see by all of these little logos I put on this slide. So because they're so important to users, they actually expect good performance from these applications. And the diversity of these applications actually makes this kind of hard, because improving application performance, it's not trivial, and these apps are developed by people with a sort of wide range of technical backgrounds and things like that. So to solve these problems, caches are aggressively deployed. And the question that we'd like to ask is, can we do something about improving these hit rates? So before answering that, let's look at how application caching is actually used on the web. So here we have a typical web client, which is making HTTP requests to a application on a multi-tiered data center. This application is interacting with a storage tier, and then also using an application cache, something like Redis or Memcached, as a look aside. Now, there are a lot of properties here that make these caches perform somewhat differently than a traditional cache. So requests coming from the clients follow a web-like request pattern, which is slightly different than you would see on a traditional cache. And then finally, the way that the web applications themselves are interacting with the storage tier and the cache tier lead to various properties, things like varying item costs, item expirations, and so on. So if we want to improve the caching performance, what we're really looking at improving is the eviction. So if you have a long-tailed workload, like in a web app, fundamentally, you cannot cache everything. So your hit rate and your miss rate will depend on what you choose to kick out. And in an ideal world, you're going to kick out the things that are least likely to be requested by your users. So to do this, you want to tailor your caching strategy to the particular setting. So as I said before, web apps are different than disk or CPU caches. Here, size and cost are very important. The request patterns that the cache sees are slightly different. So this leads to two different goals for tailoring the eviction strategy. One is that we want to tailor to web-specific request distributions, and the other is that we want to be able to handle the varying needs of different applications. Traditional caching strategies have some issues when it comes to doing this. So if you look at LRU or other recency-based approaches, these perform generally pretty well, but on the sort of stable memoryless distributions that you would see on the web, these are outperformed by frequency strategies. Now, if you look at a typical implementation of a frequency strategy, something like LFU, it has other problems. So in the traditional implementation, you evict the item that has the fewest hits. This punishes new items, and it actually allows old items, which may have shifted in their popularity, to remain in the cache even after dropping in importance. So there is actually many variants that people have looked at to improve these strategies. We're not the first people to have thought about this. So if you look at Greedy Dual, they try to incorporate cost with some notion of recency. People have looked at using this cost to blend frequency with recency. There's also approaches that use multiple LRU queues. ARC is a self-balancing approach that uses multiple LRU queues. There's even some strategies that model this as an optimization problem and then use a priority queue or something else to evict items. Now, the problem that all of these variants eventually run into is that at the end of the day, they're trying to use a data structure to do efficient eviction. So they want to make sure that they're actually evicting the minimum item, so they use like a priority queue or some other data structure to do their eviction. And in that way, they're limiting how they're actually prioritizing their items. So the key insight of our work is that we're going to focus on actually prioritizing items. And in that way, we're going to decouple these item priorities from eviction data structures and open up the space of how we actually choose these priorities. But how are we actually going to do this? So if we don't have data structures, we have to have some way to do eviction. So what we're going to do is we're going to use random sampling. In random sampling, we're going to sample some set of items from the cache, evaluate their priorities, and then kick out the lowest item among that set. And that way, you can sort of approximate the lowest item. Now, because of this, item priorities don't need to be tied to any particular data structure, which allows us to prioritize items in entirely new ways. Why do we think that this is a good idea now? Well, so if you look at systems already deployed, systems such as Redis, they're already using random sampling. So Redis does this for efficiency and simplicity of implementation. There's also been some theoretical justification that already shows that this approach can work. However, none of these strategies have proposed an eviction strategy that actually leverages this flexibility from sort of the ground up. So what we're going to do is present a new cache eviction strategy that really depends sort of fundamentally on this property. So here we propose hyperbolic caching, which is a flexible caching scheme where we define a priority function and then use lazy evaluation coupled with sampling to actually do our eviction. And to do this, we're going to focus on defining specifically how important an object is rather than trying to tie ourselves to some sort of implementation data structure. So we define a priority function that says that the priority of a given item is just the number of accesses that we've seen for that item divided by the amount of time that that item has spent in the cache. And then we allow for some different variations on this priority scheme for different settings. So what the two components of this priority function are doing are rather simple. So here, the number of accesses, this is trying to capture the fact that the distributions that a web application sees come from like independent draws of an underlying popularity distribution. So this allows our priority function to perform a lot better than, say, LRU. And then the second component, this time component, attempts to address the problems that typical frequency strategies have by trying to directly measure the relative popularity of a given item. So while that priority function might look relatively straightforward, it actually has some interesting properties when you try to go about implementing it. So here, let's look at an example stream of requests and see what happens as their priorities evolve over time. So at time t equals 1, we get one request for item A, and the priority of A is just equal to 1. After the second request, the priority of A is the same, just 1. Now we get a request for a new item. Here, the priority of A has dropped to 2/3, and the priority of B is 1. So here, B has higher priority than A. And now we start making requests for a third item, an unrelated item. And we can see at time t equals 4, now their priorities are equal. And finally, if we request C again, the priority of A is actually now greater than the priority of B. Okay? So A and B here, they actually reordered when an unrelated item was requested. So if you tried to implement this with like a traditional caching strategy, you would have to be doing a lot of churn in the underlying data structure as all of these item reorderings are happening when various requests are being made. So to implement something like this, really it's only possible because of the random sampling approach that we're taking. So how does this actually perform? So first, we looked at a standard Zipfian popularity distribution with caches of varying sizes. and then compare the miss rate of hyperbolic caching and LFU to LRU. So because we're comparing miss rates, here lower is better. As we can see, hyperbolic caching in orange performs a lot better than LRU, so between like 15 and 20% better. And LFU also does pretty well. And this just shows that on these static workloads that you can sort of expect on the web, frequency-based approaches might work a lot better than recency-based approaches. Okay, so we also looked at some real traces. So we looked at traces provided by Memcachier, which is a caching as a service company. So there are 16 applications with cache sizes chosen by the application developers. And we compared hyperbolic caching to the native Redis caching, which is LRU. And we can see that for a handful of applications, hyperbolic caching performs much, much better than LRU. So we see like 20 to 15% improvement. And then for a slight fraction of applications, it performs a bit worse. Why that's happening is something we'll return to in a later slide as we talk about how we can tailor hyperbolic caching to different settings. So hyperbolic caching, the flexibility of it sort of allows you to deal with many different kinds of sort of specific requirements of applications. And we look at just three of those. So we look at one, dealing with item costs. So items may impose like different CPU or database load when they experience a miss. This can happen because an item is the result of a join or something rather than a simple lookup. You might also have item sizes which affect hit rates. Incorporating this is pretty easy. We just multiply the cost by the original priority. Apps can also define expiration times, which if the cache is aware of, it can increase performance by incorporating that. So we have a sort of decay function that we could use to incorporate that. And then finally, we also introduce a new notion of item classes, where if the developer knows that items may have related costs and that they should be sort of grouped together, we can support using grouped costs rather than individual costs for different items. And what's cool about this is that actually if the cost of the group changes while items are in the cache, we can sort of update the cost for all of the items at the same time without ever flushing or remeasuring item costs. Right. So first, let's look at maybe cost-aware caching. So the state of the art for cost-aware caching is greedy dual. So this is a well-known approach for incorporating cost into LRU. However, the implementation of this is not trivial. So if you want to go from a cache that today has LRU to a cache that has greedy dual, it requires like changing the sort of fundamental data structures in your cache. Whereas going from hyperbolic caching to hyperbolic caching with cost, all that you really need to do is add some metadata and then redefine the priority function. So it can be pretty straightforward. Furthermore, greedy dual, because it's based on recency, suffers on web workloads sort of the same way that LRU does. Okay, so we're going to look back at those Memcachier traces from before, but now we're going to use cost awareness to deal with varying item sizes. So here, again, we're comparing to the baseline LRU performance, but we've added two new algorithms. One is hyperbolic caching with size awareness, and the other is greedy dual with size awareness. As we can see, both of these sort of tailored strategies improve performance somewhat drastically at times over LRU. And hyperbolic caching with size awareness actually performs very competitively with greedy dual size, which is pretty good for an approach that required significantly less implementation. Okay. So cost classes, this is actually a feature I guess I'm pretty excited about, because actually implementing cost classes without this random sampling approach would be kind of difficult, because if you wanted to, say, change the costs for an entire group of items, like 10,000 items, while they're still in the cache, you would have to touch all of them in like a traditional strategy. Whereas with our random sampling approach, you don't need to do that. You can just update like one variable, and then the entire cost of the group will change. Okay, so there's a number of use cases where this might be useful. So if you imagine that you have items on different backends, and then you can associate each backend with like a class of items, so that if one of your backends experiences transient load, you can change the cost that the cache is measuring for those items without having to flush items. So we set up an experiment where we do exactly this. So here we have an application that is making requests to two different backends, and then assigns items from each backend to different classes. So we run this experiment, and at a certain point in time, 2 minutes into the experiment, we stressed one of the backends, and then measured tail latency after that point. So here we graph the performance of two different systems. One is caching with tracking costs per item, and the other is tracking costs sort of per class. And as we can see in the per item case, once we load one of the backends, it takes time for the system to adjust to the knowledge that like one of the backends is now slower. So we see a spike in tail latency that is not experienced by the sort of class-aware approach. Because the class-aware approach can rapidly see that like one of the backends is now slow, and it just updates the costs of all of the items that are resident, so it doesn't need to do the flush. Okay. So there's a whole lot of related work in caching. Generally, it's been a pretty well-studied problem. But in recent years, there's been some interest in like the systems community in looking at how application caching can be implemented more efficiently in different settings. So like whether it's like different storage, like flash, or it's like cloud settings and things like that. But for a full discussion, really, of all this related work, I'd take a look at our paper. So in conclusion, by focusing on prioritizing items rather than the underlying data structures, hyperbolic caching improves cache performance on web-like workloads. This scheme allows for a ton of different easily constructed variants that allow you to tailor your caching to different settings. And we demonstrate performance as good as competitive baselines, and in many cases, actually better. Our prototype and our simulation code is all available open source on GitHub, so check it out if you want to. Okay.
Tao Lu from NJIT. This is groundbreaking work. So my question is, based on your talk, you say for eviction, there's no data structure combined with it. So that means whenever requiring a eviction, you need to decide which item to be evicted. So you use a priority to decide it, right?
Yes. So we have like a priority function.
Yeah.
That we lazily evaluate. So we'll sample like 60 items or something, evaluate the priority function on all of them, and then kick out the lowest.
So what's the computational cost of that? Is the CPU intensive or not?
So the most CPU intensive part of that is actually the sampling. Uh-huh. But in our implementation in Redis, like it was already doing this. Because they didn't want the sort of the overhead that they felt LRU had. So the overhead that we experience over the vanilla Redis was very low.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Carl Walzberger, Cache Physics. This is really nice work. I'm just kind of curious, and you partially answered it in addressing the last question, how many samples you need to use on, in general, and does the number of samples you need depend on the priority function in any way?
So for our experiments, we used a sample size of 64, which was much more than needed in most cases for performance. So in our paper, we have a couple of graphs where we measure caching performance for various sampling rates and also different sampling strategies. So there's been some prior work that looked at like trying to pre-seed your sampling with like known bad cases and stuff like that. And we found that for most of our workloads, very low sampling rates.
Okay, I've seen that sort of thing for LRU, but I was curious how that varied when you had more complex priority functions.
Right, so if you're priority function has like non-linearities in it. So like the expiration function that I showed has some of these properties. So if it has like sharp drop-offs, then accuracy might become more important for you, but it's just, it's not something we saw necessarily
Thank you.
In our.
Yeah, my question is similar. You sampling, but with sampling, you still need to track each individual object's priority, right? You need to update them, so you decide which one should be replaced.
Yes, that's true. So we don't actively track the priority per se, just the metadata required to sort of compute it. In our case, that was like the number of accesses, the time it entered the cache, or something like the cost or size of the object. So updating those things, very easy on an access. It's just metadata.
So when you decide to choose one with high or low priority to replace, you need to basically scan the list of objects and identify the one with low priority, right? Is that, how about the cost, computational cost for that operation?
Right, so when we sampled like 64 objects, we didn't perceive, like there was no measurable difference in the time to do an eviction versus native Redis, which was already doing this, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Great talk. One quick question. So in order to compute, even though you're doing the lazy evaluation of the priority function, it looks like you need to maintain metadata for each of the objects. Is that correct?
Yes.
With respect to the priority function, and that metadata itself could be different depending on what the priority function is?
Yes.
What was kind of your experience with respect to the overhead of capacity-wise or in any other respect? Because when you have a large number of tiny objects, you know, maintaining metadata per object can be prohibitive.
Yeah. So in the sort of like, if you look at like the design documents or whatever of Redis, they claim that like the reason that they're doing this sampling is because it's lower memory overhead than LRU. Like they're tracking something like a 32-bit piece of metadata instead of two pointers. And in our implementation, we only added like one more 32-bit piece of metadata. Mm-hmm. So it's actually still just two pointers.
Okay.
The metadata overhead can be quite low if you're aware of it.
Okay. Thank you very much.